Illinois faces some big challenges. Today, you're about to hear a truly honest analysis of the problems we face. Equally important, you'll also hear an in-depth discussion of some practical solutions. This is your radio source for stories, insight, and the answers you won't hear anywhere else. Not in the media, and not coming from Springfield. You're listening to Illinois Rising, presented by the Illinois Policy Institute. Now, here's your host, Dan Proft.
Thank you for joining us on another edition of Illinois Rising. I'm Dan Proft. You can catch me Monday through Friday, Chicago's Morning Answer, 5 a.m. to 9 a.m. on AM 560 with Amy Jacobson. And joining me as our guest host on this edition is Eric Cohn. He's a marketing manager for the Illinois Policy Institute. Eric, welcome.
Good to be here.
And so City of Chicago is doing its best to stamp out entrepreneurial capitalism, and it's doing a pretty good job. I mean, I must admit, the latest instance of this is a Cook County Circuit Court judge, because it's really a three-branch effort to stamp out entrepreneurial capitalism here in Chicago and Cook County. Cook County Circuit Court judge ruling in favor of the City of Chicago in a lawsuit concerning regulation of food trucks in the city. You see the food trucks around if you amble about the city, looking for something to eat around lunchtime, all kinds of offerings. Well, here's the rules that food trucks challenged with the help of food truck operators challenged with the help of the Institute for Justice. Cannot operate within 200 feet of a brick and mortar business that sells food, which includes everything from McDonald's to CVS to, you know, what you would traditionally think of sit down restaurants. And also you have to plug in a GPS tracker so that the government knows where you are at all times. The Cook County Circuit Court judge, in his infinite wisdom, ruled that both of those were constitutional. The Institute for Justice has promised to appeal the ruling. And what's the Illinois Policy Institute and your particular perspective on this, Eric?
It's disappointing. It's incredibly disappointing. Look, people benefit from more options. And, you know, the kind of sit-down restaurants that you've referenced, I mean, these are different dining experiences. You know, if you're really looking for fine dining, you know, I can think, oh, well, yeah, I'm going to go stop at a food truck then. So it's more options for people. And talk about onerous. I mean, you go walk around downtown in the Loop, try to find a place where you can be 200 feet away from any of these things, from a CVS, from a McDonald's, from a Jimmy John's, from, you know, any of the various sit-down restaurants. They're squeezing them entirely out of downtown and eliminating something that people tend to like.
The tracker is particularly Orwellian, too. I don't like that at all. But the circuit court judge in Cook County, of course, obviously a constitutional scholar, otherwise it wouldn't be on the bench in Cook County. For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined by Laura Pekarik. She is the plaintiff in this case. She is a food truck operator. The food truck that she operates provides cupcakes for courage, right?
That's right.
All right. Laura, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
So the basis for this suit, you obviously thought the two regulations that we described were onerous and negatively impacted your ability to run your business. Give us the kind of the genesis of your food truck business idea to focus on cupcakes. And there's so many brick and mortar cupcakes. I mean, I don't really understand it, but cupcakes drive people insane. I see them in my neighborhood. They're brick and mortars, cupcake stores, just cupcakes and coffee and whatnot, but they seem to always be packed. And so you decided to take a similar concept, but make it mobile. Why?
Well, definitely, I agree that people go crazy over cupcakes. I saw that, and realizing that I think certain individuals probably thought that it was a fad and it would go out of style after a while, but they're definitely here to stay, as we can see that for many years now. About 5 years ago, when my sister was undergoing her treatment for cancer, she's in remission, and she's doing really well right now, we were experimenting with cupcake flavors and baking, and it became a passion of mine about cupcakes and taking our regular desserts that you see in a wide variety of places in restaurants and stores and putting them into cupcake form. And so at the same time that my sister was finishing her treatment and kind of getting her life back to normalcy, food trucks were becoming more popular, and we saw a couple of them pop up in our area and in Chicago. And so we did see another cupcake truck, and we thought, we could definitely do this. Like, I think our cupcakes are really good. And so we kind of went on the path to that, and I found a food truck, and I had some recipes, a recipe book that I created, and so I bought the food truck with my savings that I had and outfitted it to be a mobile cupcake truck with the license process and took it to the road.
Why go the food truck route and why not, you know, as I'm sure the kind of brick-and-mortar cupcakes joints would say, you know, sprinkles or whichever cupcake joints, why don't you just do a storefront like them so it's a level playing field? This is the kind of argument that brick-and-mortar restaurants make.
Well, I think that for me, being someone like myself, I didn't have as much like classical experience. I wasn't classically trained, and I wanted to work for myself. And so with the food truck opportunity, although it was a great investment I had to make, and I still had to find a commissary. I still pay rent. Mm-hmm. And when I was just a food truck, of course, I own a brick and mortar now. But I still paid rent, I still paid sales tax, I had to pay garbage, water, all of these things. And I decided, instead of to have a storefront where, you know, people would come to me, I wanted to go to my customers and find them. Instead of being in one location and picking it, I wanted to be able to travel around and go where my customers, I felt my customers were, and I found them to be.
So what was the experience like running a food truck, and particularly what was it like facing these regulations that you can't be within 200 feet of a brick and mortar restaurant and this GPS tracker so that they can know where you are at any given time?
Well, in the beginning, when there was just a handful of food trucks out there, when it, like, food trucks just came to the Chicago market, I would definitely say that it was more simple, and there were more parking opportunities available, just being that the market wasn't saturated. Parking in Chicago as a consumer or just someone trying to get from point A to point B and park their car is difficult. I'm sure many people are aware of this. And we can't take our truck into a parking garage, which makes it convenient for the consumer. So being on the streets, we had to try to find our parking spots the best we could in the legal zones, because the 200-foot rule was there always, even when I got licensed. But then in 2012, as food trucks became ever more popular and business owners were just packaging their goods at their commissary, like I described earlier, and then putting them on the truck, in 2012, the city of Chicago changed the laws and made it available for us to prepare the food on truck and cook on board, like, you know, you see in other cities and things like that, which in theory, this is a wonderful thing. Great. Let's have like a more like diverse food options out there and available. However, with that, in consideration that all these food truckers thought, this is great, like, let's do this. This is a great business opportunity. Let's try this out. Parking didn't change. It still was difficult. So when I started in 2011, when there was just a handful of food trucks out there, and it did get ever increasing over time, it became even more difficult once they made this ordinance change, and more trucks came to market, but the parking didn't change. So.
How does that compare to other major cities? Do you know, like L.A., New York, other major cities, and how they handle food trucks?
Oh, it varies from city to city. I mean, I don't know particularly. I wouldn't be able to quote certain towns for you, but I know that this is very unheard of, specifically the way that the city of Chicago does it, that they can balance the interests of restaurants and food trucks. I don't think any city has done that.
What is the relationship between like your food truck and the you know, restaurants or brick and mortar proprietors? I mean, is there really antagonism, or is this in part kind of politically generated with just a few voices that are being given disproportionate power through their city council members?
Well, I know for a fact, in my experience, when food trucks, I would love to give you dates, but I mean, it's just a feeling. I've been doing this for 5 years now. In the beginning, after about a year, when food trucks, again, more, the city was issuing more food truck licenses and it became a more popular business endeavor, the restaurants were becoming more stringent upon us and looked at, down upon us as like a burden to them. And so when, if a truck, and it's very complicated, 200 feet, you know, you'd have to really take like a tape measure out there with you. There are certain islands, and we described this in our case, that there's certain islands that it pushes all the food trucks to. And restaurants definitely would come out and like restaurant owners and say, you can't be here and we're going to call the cops on you. And sometimes, you know, and this is not only for my personal experience, but there's other trucks. And of course, there's a community of us that we would talk to each other and we were trying to figure this whole situation out. Like, how do we, you know, operate our business, sell to our customers? You know, our customers are calling for us on Facebook and Twitter to be in these certain locations. And how do we combat this?
Laura, we're going to have to leave it there. Laura Pekarik. She's the owner of Cupcakes for Courage. And Laura, good luck with the appeal of the Cook County Circuit Court ruling in this case. We appreciate you joining us. Dan Prof back with Eric Cohen, Marketing Manager for the Illinois Policy Institute on this edition of Illinois Rising. And with the Trump State of Indiana deal to save jobs at the Carrier facility in Indianapolis from being shipped down to Mexico, there's been a renewed attention on manufacturing in the Midwest, the Rust Belt. And Eric, it's just staggering. I mean, I don't think people have an appreciation for how far behind Illinois is from our Midwest neighbors. Illinois Policy Institute has done the numbers, these numbers as of July of this year. So from the bottom of the Great Recession to July of this year, these numbers are just staggering. 50,400 manufacturing jobs created in Wisconsin. 75,900 created in Ohio, 171,300 in Michigan, 20,100 in Illinois.
One of these things is not like the other.
Yeah, one of these things is down by 8x to the state of Michigan, now almost 9x. You know, we're still scratching our heads saying, what's going on in Illinois that's not going on in the rest of the nation? And even just in the rest of the Great Lakes, in addition to our voting habits, but maybe one thing leads to the other. For a perspective from a practitioner who left Illinois for Indiana, we're happy to be joined again by Vince Flaska. He's the president of Hoist Lift Truck. He and his father, Marty, have been in touch with Mike Pence, previous governor, well, still governor, but you know how that's playing out. And soon to be governor-elect now, Eric Holcomb, the new incoming governor of Indiana. They left Bedford Park for Indiana. They've moved their operations out of Illinois into other states, did Hoist Lift Truck. Vince, thanks so much for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
So for a refresher, you're the length of time your company, Hoist Lift Truck, was in Bedford Park in Illinois, and the calculus that prompted you to say, nope, it's time to pull up stakes and move to Indiana.
Yeah, so we've been in Illinois since 1992. My dad has been self-employed since 18 years old and has always had companies in Illinois. We moved to Bedford Park in 1998, and then we recently just moved to Indiana in 2015. We were fully operational in 2016. We actually still keep some businesses in Bedford Park. The only reason being, it's probably the only city in all of Illinois, especially Cook County, where they have the pro-business environment.
So you said you've had communication with Mike Pence since coming to Indiana. I mean, what has that looked like? How receptive have they been? I mean, we see businesses and manufacturers leaving for Indiana. What has that experience been like working with elected officials like that?
Yeah, so, you know, Victor Smith is the Secretary of Commerce, and he was really involved in this project with IEDC. And, I mean, when you compare that to Illinois, we had one person coming from Illinois. They walked through our facility, and initially Illinois gave us no offer for any kind of tax credits. And what prompted us actually looking to move was the fact that there was a news article in 2014 that Coyote Logistics received a $2.5 million grant to create 500 jobs, and they already had an existing EDGE tax credit for $2.3 million. And they're only looking to invest $4 million. We ended up investing five times that amount. So when we first looking at incentives, that's what started this whole process. We said that if, you know, Coyote Logistics, which hires mostly, you know, college kids, young kids, and we're hiring blue-collar workers that have families and invest in the community, you would think it would make sense that we could receive tax cuts as well. Well, that wasn't the case. So when Illinois gave us no offer initially, that's what, you know, when we decided, all right, we're really going to consider Indiana. And Indiana came on strong. You know, they sent their Secretary of Commerce the very second meeting. So they really work hard to get these manufacturing jobs. And, you know, all around Indiana is a better state to do business. But when you look at how Indiana has, you know, they have the reforms, how they use these incentives for economic development, it's very, very different than what Illinois has done in the past.
What's your position on those economic incentive packages? You know, I mean, it's kind of, there are, you know, rules and guidelines ostensibly, but it's all very much, it seems to me, operates on the whimsy of bureaucrats and politicians. And so would it be better as a manufacturer to say, here's the entire business climate, from your tax burden to what the workers' comp system looks like to unemployment insurance, you know, all of the energy costs, all of the cost drivers for operating a business, and everybody's kind of got the same deal and nobody gets to petition the state for a special deal? Would that be better? Or do you like the idea of states competing by using, you know, taxpayer money and tax credits and other mechanisms, other kind of economic development tools, if you will, to try and incentivize one company over another in a particular sector?
Well, you know, it's kind of a double-edged sword because, you know, I still live in Illinois and I want to see Illinois succeed. But the problem that they have is that if they get rid of how their edge tax credits function, where basically they're the only state that gives tax credits out to retain companies, Indiana does not do that. What Indiana does, and what most people don't get, is like for the carrier deal, is it's technically they're creating more jobs too down the road. I don't even know if carrier received edge tax credits. It hasn't been released what they received, but in Indiana, if we said right now to Indiana, we're leaving and we're bringing our jobs to Illinois, give us tax credits, they would say, per their state statute, well, we're only going to give you tax credits for the new jobs that you're creating, an edge tax credit. Now, there's other mechanisms, personal property tax abatements, which Illinois doesn't have personal property tax, and they also have the real estate, they can give you real estate tax abatements as well. So that's some of the stuff that Indiana does. But in Illinois, if you were to say, I'm leaving, they would give you tax credits. They're the only state in this country that's giving tax credits out to keep companies from leaving, and that's because there's no reform in the state. If there was reform, they wouldn't have to do that. And so in Illinois, it's a waste of taxpayers' dollars. So if you look at the Coyote example, really, what kind of economic development did that bring to the community? You know, the economic development that Illinois needs is, you know, working class, you know, blue collar workers that all these manufacturing jobs have left the state. It's not going to be the office job in the city that we need.
In addition to these, the kind of this use of tax credits and mostly at the whim of politicians, what are the other driving factors that, you know, led you to look outside of the state of Illinois? I mean, what else is causing this kind of turmoil that we see driving manufacturers out?
I mean, the biggest thing is workers' comp reform. And so the thing is, you know, it would be great if everybody could get some of these tax credits and could be in an environment where there's reform. But if you look at a company that was 50 people, and they tried looking at moving to Indiana, it's probably not feasible. But if they have one bad workers' comp case because the system is so corrupt in Illinois, it could put that guy out of business. Indiana all around is a better state with workers' comp reform. How the whole entire state government works, where they're not constantly trying to basically tax companies and find a way to take another dime. You know, the perfect example would be we had disgruntled employees in Indiana say that we had no drinking water, that our water had lead, et cetera, et cetera. It was completely fabricated. And in Indiana, you know, they don't send an inspector out here to go do that. They say you have a certain amount of time to respond, and this is the Indiana OSHA, et cetera, you know, and you do it. And they know it's a disgruntled employee. Versus in Illinois, they waste their resources. They send somebody out, go inspect the building. But they'll find something else to find you. We received OSHA fines, and when we were in Illinois, for stuff that was completely outlandish. And I've been working there since I've been 13 years old. And, you know, we've never had a death in our factory. It's a safe place. And it's just the entire environment. It's kind of a weight lifted off our shoulders. Me and my dad operating in Indiana. Now we can go focus on our company and not have to worry about all the headaches of being at the Thompson Center dealing with workers' comp issues.
And it, you know, was part of that then, not just kind of the system, well, the structure of the system in terms of the costs it distributes, but then also the adjudicative process in terms of what you're describing, the anecdote you're sharing, you know, kind of the lack of a authority to which to appeal that would mete out some, you know, common sense and some equity, you know, as you're just litigating through a star chamber that's an organ of the state and then a star chamber that's, you know, Cook County judge.
Yep.
No.
I mean, it's
simple enough.
It's, yeah,
two different worlds doing business in Indiana versus Illinois, and then, you know, how they both. Indiana has the reform, and I really hope that Illinois can get that reform someday.
We're talking to Vincent Flaska. He's the president at Hoist Lift Truck, now formerly of Bedford Park, generally, now of East Chicago, Indiana. Vincent, can you hang on for 1 second? I've got a couple of questions. Yes. I want to address some federal issues with you as it pertains to manufacturing as well. We're going to be continuing with Vincent Flaska right after the break. Dan Prof back with Eric Cohen, marketing manager for Illinois Policy Institute on this edition of Illinois Rising. And we're talking to Vincent Flaska. He is the president of Hoist Lift Truck in East Chicago, Indiana, formerly of Illinois. I'm talking a little bit about the calculus that sent his family's company across the border. And Vincent, before we get to some federal issues and what a Trump presidency may mean for the manufacturing sector in this country, the state and this country, this region and this country, I had an interesting call on my morning show this week. It was from a guy, you know, when I made a reference to how much better Wisconsin and other states are performing than Illinois. So, well, yeah, we'll go, well, you know, why don't you move to Wisconsin and enjoy Wisconsin level taxation? And it turns out, if you look at the numbers, Wisconsin's kind of state and local total tax burden is very similar to Illinois's. And that was his point. But the point he didn't contemplate is the fact that Wisconsin may have the same tax burden as Illinois, but they also have a budget surplus, and they also have nearly fully funded public sector pensions, and they also have innovations in their urban centers like school choice to try and improve the quality of K-12 education. So is it fair to say that, you know, part of this conversation that sometimes lost is not just the costs imposed by government on businesses or private individuals, you're both, but also, you know, kind of what we're getting in return, whereas for Illinois, the tax burden that we're paying, similar to our cheesehead friends to the north, gets us $11 billion in unpaid bills, $230 billion in debt, and the worst credit rating of any state in the country in the last 25 years. So something very different is happening with the resources that are being directed to state government, and that matters too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you made a great point with the school systems. So Indiana obviously has a budget surplus as well, but when my dad was in high school, he could take welding classes and wood shop. A lot of those classes are no longer in Illinois schools. And Indiana, they're offering machining, welding, you know, learning how to run a CNC machine. So when these kids graduate from high school, if they don't want to go to college, they can go and take on a job where they're making $50,000 to $60,000 a year. And you don't have that in Illinois. And I'm sure Wisconsin's the same way. There's a better workforce because the education system's better. And you're completely right. The infrastructure is better as well. East Chicago has its own fiber throughout the city.
So one of the things that Donald Trump, I think, undeniably tapped into is, you know, people in these kinds of regions that are, you know, like those micro type dirty jobs that wanted that honest kind of 40-hour work week. A lot of that falls into manufacturing as well. So what, you know, what do you see, what does Donald Trump pretend to you for the future of manufacturing, not just in this region, but in the country writ large?
Well, I mean, I think it's huge for manufacturing. If you just look at U.S. steel alone, how much steel output has risen since he's been, you know, basically, you know, the president-elect, it's impressive. Even for us as a manufacturer and a lot of other heavy equipment manufacturers, we were seeing a downward trend in sales orders. 3 days after Trump was elected, we received some pretty large orders from larger manufacturers' steel plants. So it's a really positive outlook for us. And, you know, steel used to be dirt cheap about 2-3 months ago. We've seen steel prices increase 15% to 20% over the board. So, yeah, the cost of material might be more for us, but it's better for everybody else that, you know, the entire business environment manufacturing will be better in the U.S.
But just going back to Illinois and compare that to the posture of a Donald Trump, the posture, frankly, of other Midwestern governors, Walker and Daniels and Pence and now Holcomb and Kasich and Snyder and Branstad and on and on. It seems to me like we can look around and see, okay, well, here's a better way to do workers' comp, for example. So it's not an idea problem. It's a political will problem. And I wonder how you would compare your interaction to elected officials in Illinois versus the Midwest versus, the vice president-elect.
So, you know, we worked with Congressman Lipinski a lot in Bedford Park, and he did an amazing job getting us a TLA contract. Aside from that, working with, Illinois, I believe it was DECA or DECA at the time, not that great. There was a lack of communication. Maybe they were underfunded. They didn't have enough manpower. Versus when dealing with Indiana, it was a lot different. And now one of the issues we have is more on a federal level, maybe I could get into it, is so when we sell product into Europe, we have a 4.5% duty. There's other manufacturers like Hyster Yale that have Kentucky. They have a subsidiary in Kentucky, but they manufacture all these large trucks overseas. They actually have a DLA contract that goes to our military, and these contracts are in the billions, and these trucks are manufactured overseas. Just one of these contracts, even if it wasn't for our company, but there's other U.S. manufacturers that make similar products like us, those are hundreds, if not thousands, of jobs that should be in the U.S. And I think that's something that will be addressed in the next administration, which is why you see, business is good for manufacturers right now, and there's a really big positive outlook.
All right. He is Vincent Flaska, the president of Hoist Lift Truck. Vince, we miss you and your company, but we understand. We don't hold it against you. Thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Have a good day.
Dan Proff back with Eric Cohn, Marketing Manager for the Illinois Policy Institute on this edition of Illinois Rising. And one thing that came to pass this week, we talked about on this show previously, was the window temporary closed potentially for Governor Rauner with respect to AFSCME, the union that represents the greatest number of state workers on the order of 37,000, and that had been the subject of a declaration of labor impasse between the governor and AFSCME with respect to AFSCME's contract that has been an ongoing negotiation for the better part of a year and a half. And AFSCME took that written declaration from the Illinois State Labor Relations Board to a St. Clair County court, interesting choice, and got a St. Clair County judge to issue a temporary restraining order pushing Governor Rauner back to the negotiating table, where there have been something on the order of 50-plus meetings and 200 different proposals to run in place. Sounds very much like the budget back and forth. So, Eric Cohn, on the matter of AFSCME going to St. Clair County Court to get this TRO, why there, and what does this temporary restraining order mean for how the contract will shake out between the governor and AFSCME, the state workers union?
Simple answer: why St. Clair County? Friendly venue.
Right.
The judge that they go to, and this is all interesting because rather than take it to an appellate court, which is the more traditional manner to take an appeal like this, they take it to a lower court, and they take it to a judge, Robert Lachine, who has a bit of an interesting story himself. So many of the judges there are incredibly friendly with the trial bar, have been incredibly friendly with kind of a union-dominated politics in St. Clair County.
Madison, St. Clair County, the Metro East, from where you hail.
Exactly.
Routinely rated one of the quote-unquote judicial hellholes of America by the American Tort Reform Association, by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
Absolutely. I mean, you could look into the way that, much of the asbestos litigation in Madison County is really, a wholly owned subsidiary of the trial lawyers that practice there. It's crazy. So Lachine's has an interesting story. I mean, he is one of three judges in St. Clair County that, rather than stand for retention, which has a higher bar, he chose to resign his seat and run for election, so to lower the level of accountability that voters can basically pass
he
on him.
He would just need 50% plus one if he runs for re-election, whereas 60% for retention.
And for what it's worth, maybe you can see why he wanted to do this, because you mentioned, 50% plus one. He got almost 51% of the vote running for election in a rather Democrat-dominated county, running against a Republican and a no Republican. That tells you something, I think. It's interesting choice that they made for where to go, and I think it's pretty obvious why.
Right. There's no accidents here. AFSCME knows the political landscape. They know what goes on in Madison, St. Clair counties. And it's interesting that you would have such a competitive judicial race. That tells you that residents of St. Clair County are getting, at least many of them, getting wise to the rackets that are run as well. But now, in terms of, that is an interesting story. Now you understand why AFSCME did what it did. But now we find ourselves where Governor Rahner's kind of was slow-walking implementation of his last best final offer. Now there's the TRO that will, you know, continue to be litigated. And what is a governor to do? Because AFSCME seems like they are in the same position of House Speaker Mike Madigan. They're happy to just run out the clock, to stall, and try and take their chances defeating Rahner at the ballot box in 18.
I think that's obvious that that's the plan here. I mean, they the way that they've chosen to fight this, the way that it has been carried out over the last 2 years, show that there's a reason that the Labor Board determined that they're at an impasse, because they're at an impasse. There's no interest in actually coming together on a contract here. When you look at the demands that AFSCME is making, when you look at the demands for continually increasing salaries, increasing the share of health care payments that the taxpayers are picking up, when you look at some of the just baffling things to those of us in, you know, people in the private sector, the number of days that you can miss, just not show up.
Unexcused absences.
Just not show up for work. How many times do you think, you know, your average employee at, you know, a McDonald's or a CVS could do that and avoid being fired?
And these state workers, many of them are ostensibly in the service business, the public service business. So what's a governor to do? It seems that Rahner is not inclined, and I'm not saying he's made the ground fertile yet, but he could move in that direction to make the ground fertile, to essentially precipitate a moment where you force the Illinois electorate to choose a course. Are we going to be a state that's a wholly owned subsidiary of the public sector unions, and we all exist here to be spare parts to finance their blank check? Or are we going to chart a different course like our Midwest neighbors? And it seemed to me that, you know, based on some of the things you're saying and what we know to be true about AFSCME's demands, Rahner has a pretty strong evidentiary case to present if he wants to present it.
I think so. I think you look at both of these two battles that have been playing out over the budget and over the AFSCME contract. And of course, they are incredibly related. The amount of money that the state spends just on pensions alone and how many that's tied to government workers. Yeah, I mean, I think you have the opportunity to, as you said, make the ground fertile, make a stand here, and make the case to the people of Illinois that we need to make a course change, that there's a reason that they have been stalling and they're wanting to run out the clock, is because it's impossible to defend to good, upstanding people the things that they are asking for, and the way that the state, the trajectory that it has been on for at least 30 years, if not more, can't defend that.
Well, we'll see if we get a new argument in the new year from the same governor, Bruce Rahner. Dan Prof back with Eric Cohn, marketing manager for the Illinois Policy Institute, on this edition of Illinois Rising. And Eric, we're talking about sawing sawdust with respect to the AFSCME contract. We could say the same thing about the budget, and we were all subjected to more bad budget dinner theater this past week between the governor and legislative leaders. And I used the description leader in quotation marks. We're just kind of sawing sawdust here, too. We might as well just everybody go home, stop paying attention, stop paying state legislators, tell them not to show up. And we're just going to do a rerun of 16 and 18, right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Governor Rahner just recently announced that he was going to cancel future budget meetings until Democrats actually produce a budget proposal, which is a kind of wild idea that if we're going to debate over what the budget should look like, okay, well, pony up.
Well, and importantly, not like the one Madigan produced previously, which was $7 billion out of balance. One of those budget proposals where the expected spending is no more than the expected revenue. We call these things a balanced budget. Other states have them. We're not so keen on them.
Well, you know, Illinois is just special that way, I guess. So, you know, Mike Madigan comes out of one of the last meetings that they had. And like you said, yes, sawing sawdust. We're saying the same things over and over again. And talking about Governor Rauner holding the budget hostage, quote, to help his wealthy friends and large corporations.
Standard issue Democrat class envy politics.
Absolutely. And but what occurred to me is, okay, so can we talk about Mike Madigan and his wealthy friends and the large corporations that have been financing him, including, as we've talked about before, the public sector unions in this state? Don't want to talk about those guys, do we?
Well, the other thing about it is, right, that's the big lie. Like, this is about helping your wealthy friends. I mean, the wealthy don't need the help. That's not, the wealthy have, you know, they have a home here, but they're domiciled in Florida where there's no state income tax for 181 days of the year to establish residency. Or they're somewhere else, but they keep a footprint in Chicago. Or they otherwise protect their assets because they have a phalanx of lawyers and accountants to properly shield their money from tax implications. The wealthy don't need the help. That's why this is the biggest lie of all. They don't need Rauner's help, and they don't need Madigan's help. They got to figure it out. You know who needs the help? Is the median income household in Illinois. The family of four with a $52,000, $53,000, $55,000 household income. And they're getting blitzed. And that's why you see the out-migration, as we've talked about in this show. It's not, oh, wealthy seniors who want to go somewhere warm. That's all it is. No, it's not. It's millennials who are looking for their first job and young families that are working their way up the corporate ladder and can't make it make sense, can't make ends meet if they stay in Chicago or the metropolitan area. And even, you know, and then you get central and southern Illinois, as you know, Eric, then mm-hmm. It's job opportunities that don't exist. So that the big it's a big lie on so many levels that everything Rauner is proposing is for the worker, is for the middle income family that's trying to aspire up the ladder. It's not for wealthy friends or wealthy corporations. It's a joke.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, often in defending the idea that, well, the only solution or that the obvious solution to a lot of these people is we just need to raise taxes. Well, yeah, it turns out, as you mentioned there, that the people they keep talking about with the quote unquote ability to pay, they're also the same people with the ability to leave. And forgotten, left behind in all of this are the people for whom leaving, moving interstate. I've done it a couple times in the last couple of years. It's an expensive prospect. They are the ones that this should all be about, the ones that it would be a burden for them to consider leaving, and it's a burden for them to stay. And they're stuck in this position by no real fault of their own.
And I've referenced it before, but I want to be explicit about it. You're from Southern Illinois, Belleville area. What's Southern Illinois like today versus when you were growing up 20 years ago?
Go drive through Belleville, which is the town that I'm from. The west end of Belleville has been hollowed out. Businesses have been closing. People have been leaving. It's not the same community that it was. It has been a slow progression of this over 30 years.